Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, March 1st, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call today on the newly released report by the Henry Jackson Society, Al-Qaeda in the United States, A Complete Analysis of Terrorism Offenses. I'm David Ray, Associate Director of the Federalist Society's Practice Groups. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are solely those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome the authors of the report, Mr. Robin Simcox, will be the first one to speak. He is the research fellow at the Henry Jackson Society, and he is the co-author of the recently released report, Al-Qaeda in the United States, A Complete Analysis of Terrorism Offenses. After presentation by the co-authors of the report, Mr. Andrew McCarthy, the executive director of the Philadelphia Freedom Center and a contributing editor for National Review, will provide commentary. More complete bios of our speakers were provided to you in the notice of the call, so we will stop there and preserve more time for the presentations, followed by your questions. Please note that today's call must conclude at 1:45 p.m. Mr. Simcox, the floor is yours.
Thank you, and thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting me and your interest in this publication.
Now I can hang on. Okay.
To give you a little context into the report itself, it's a study based on America and Americans' experience with Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorism, but its context and its history is based in the UK experience. After the July 2005 London bombings, 7/7, which 52 people died, the British government launched a review into the events of that day. And one of the, to our minds, shocking things that it discovered was that it didn't even have a list of individuals in the UK who'd committed terrorism offences. So we decided to try and fill the gap and provide that list. And as we began to compile the data, it became interesting to us to know not only who these the names of the individuals, but where they lived, what their lives were like, what their education status was. Whether they had a job, whether they'd received training abroad, those kinds of things. So we released two reports in the UK that filled that information gap and provided a big statistical data set for the UK government and the UK government integrated these findings into its reviews of both the counterterrorism strategy, but also the de-radicalization strategy, PREVENT. So the intention was, with the American response, in our eyes, still fluid, still coming up with the most effective response to the threat of radicalization terrorism in the U.S. homeland, we tried to produce a similar report for the U.S., looking at all Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorists and who these individuals were. So I co-authored the report with Emily Dyer, who is going to take you through some of the initial findings now.
Hello there. So just to take you through some of the initial findings, there were some statistics which we found relatively unsurprising. One third of all individuals we looked at were aged from 20 to 24, and 95% were men. So the fact that the majority were young men wasn't too surprising to us. We did have several anomalies. There was one, a 64-year-old lady called Hawo Mohammed Hassan, who was raising money in Minnesota, claiming to be sending money to a Somali aid effort, but in fact she was transferring thousands of dollars to Al-Shabaab, the terrorist organization. So, of course, not all of our individuals fit the pattern, but the majority were young men. What we did find surprising, though, was who these men are. If you look at the threat facing America, 54% are U.S. citizens, and that's considerably higher than the other high countries, Saudi Arabia 9%, and Pakistan was only 6%. And if you look at these U.S. citizens, these aren't just people who have flown to the country, got citizenship later in life. 36% of everyone we looked at were U.S. born. which really reflects the extent to the problem of, for want of a better phrase, homegrown terrorism. There's also a common perception that the terrorists turn to a life, they choose this path because they've fallen on hard times, they've got a lack of opportunities, and they've got this kind of socioeconomic struggles. However, while this was the case for many of the individuals we looked at, we found that the opposite was true for the majority of the time. Among everyone we looked at, 57% were in education or employment. And if you break that down, that's 13% students, 44% in employment, and 52% had attended college or above. And within those that were employed, we had highly skilled jobs, computer programmers, software engineers, pharmacists, financial analysts. So this really challenges the common perception that it's a socioeconomic thing. And I think what we think this reflects is the dominant role of ideology. So we think that this report is challenging the perception that 9/11 was brought about, that terrorists are just from far-flung tribal towns in Saudi Arabia. When in fact, these are U.S. citizens that have passed through the system rather than having been marginalized by it. And I'm going to pass back to Robin now.
So once we'd looked at some of this background information, we then tried to take it a step further and find out, well, okay, so where did these individuals live prior to their offense or at the time of charge? And one of the interesting things for our point of view is when we can compare UK and US data sets, is that in the UK, the threat tends to be much more concentrated. So nearly half of individuals in the UK, for example, who commit these offences live in London. Now, in America, it's much, much more challenging because the threat is so much more diverse. These individuals lived in every region of the country in something like 26 different states. There was individuals in Alaska, California, Oregon, Ohio, Virginia, New Jersey, Florida. Now, New York was the area where most resided, but even that was only 14% of all individuals, which when you compare that to the high UK stat of 50% of individuals in London, it makes you realize just the difficulties that the US has in appropriating resources to different states to deal with this kind of issue. We then went one step further and tried to assess, of these individuals, who had actually received terrorist training? And 47% of individuals in the RIF study had received terrorist training in camps abroad. Again, a higher statistic than that in the UK. However, what is interesting to track is while these individuals had often trained in countries like Afghanistan and Pakistan, there wasn't always a direct line from individuals then going on to, for example, have combat experience and fight in foreign war zones such as Somalia, such as Bosnia, such as Afghanistan, because only 18% of individuals had combat experience. So there is an interesting discrepancy there, and one of the fears must be, I think, that as individuals that Al-Qaeda recruits from the West become more and more valuable to them, rather than use them as cannon fodder and fight with against other local proxy governments, as may have been the case in the past, they will want to actually use them to attack either the U.S. homeland or other Western states because of the ease with which they can move around compared to, say, an operative from Saudi Arabia or Egypt. Finally, we looked at the what we designate as the mass casualty operatives. So the individuals at the sharpest end of terrorist planning, members of Al-Qaeda who were planning planning plots to kill Americans on a mass scale. Now, 21% of individuals were designated as mass casualty operatives, which gives you an idea of this isn't just individuals in the rhetorical side of terrorism or facilitation. These are people at the very sharpest end of attack planning. Furthermore, of those individuals, now while most were terrorist trained, which is what you would expect for individuals, for example, aspiring to kill Americans, create a bomb, construct a bomb, things like that, 11% hadn't received any training at all, which suggests one of the things, I think one of the trends to potentially look out for, is that these are individuals who don't need to necessarily receive training in the same traditional way of that individuals have in the past. For example, going to Pakistan, joining up with AQC, Al-Qaeda Central, receiving training, and then coming back. These are people who feel the they have the intent, the ability, the desire to do what they can with what they have. I think that's a particularly interesting strain of terrorism to look out for in the future. Now, the report aims to provide a as thorough as possible statistical data set for the U.S. government and other practitioners and policymakers to begin to make informed decision about the level of the threat and where the threat may emanate from. I'm aware there's no perfect scientific approach to de-radicalization, counter-radicalization, terrorism, but what it tries to do is to provide the best resources we've had yet in an attempt to tackle what I believe is going to be a problem that will be plaguing America for some time to come yet. So I'm going to leave it there for the time being. They're the top line findings from the report. It's over 700 pages, so there's lots more in there as well, which I'm happy to discuss. But for now, I will I'll wrap it up and turn it back over to you, David.
Thank you, Robin. And now we will turn it over to Andy McCarthy.
Well, thank you very much, and let me first begin by commending Robin and Emily on what I think is really an important work, and one that's going to require, at least ought to require, a lot of study. It brings a lot of useful wisdom to counterterrorism that we could certainly use here, and I'm looking forward to delving more into it than I've had the chance to up till this point. I thought my first reaction to what Robin was saying about Britain post 7/7 is that we had a similar experience in the United States, not so much after 9/11, although that was certainly a time of upheaval as well, but a similar experience after the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, which interestingly we marked the 20th anniversary of just 3 days ago here. Prior to the 93 bombing, our legal architecture for addressing terrorism was really appallingly weak. At the time that we had to draw up the indictments, for example, for the cases that came out of the 93 bombing, we didn't even have laws like we have now that addressed the terrorist threat because, you know, frankly, we hadn't had any systematic foreign terrorism in the United States, certainly not like we've had in the last 20 years. So I think, you know, one interesting difference perhaps between the American experience and the British experience is that we had our counterterrorism overhaul prior to 9/11. Most of the attention in the legal context, I think, most of the attention has been drawn by the post 9/11 legislation, and in particular the Patriot Act, which we spent a number of years arguing about the various provisions of it. But I think that from a standpoint of prosecuting terrorism, and you know, for the real important difference between what the legal environment was like before the terrorist threat and since the systematic terrorist threat, the 1996 overhaul of counterterrorism law, which has gotten much less attention, has actually been much more important. And it's it actually enacted provisions that enabled us in a way that we couldn't before, not only to gather intelligence about terror networks and terror cells in the United States, but also to try to interrupt them at an early stage of plots. For example, the material support to terrorism laws, which are a staple of today's counterterrorism, at least in the law enforcement field, is something that came out of the 1996 statute. And it not only became the backbone of most of our prosecutions, I think it also enabled us to learn from an intelligence standpoint a lot more about terror networks, because it encouraged inquiry into their funding streams and other provision of assets to different terrorist organizations. So I think that a lot of the methods and developments that we've had in our law, which lead to our understanding of the terrorist threat in the United States, were actually in place prior to 9/11 for all of the attention that the Patriot Act has gotten. I think the breakdown that particularly that Emily described of the different types of the backgrounds of terrorist defendants and suspects actually marries up pretty closely with what our experience was pre-9/11 as well. In the case I handled, for example, in the mid-1990s, we had about 12 defendants from the Blind Sheikhs terrorist organization. I don't think half of them were American citizens, but I think at least 4 of the 12 were. And of those, I think one was U.S. born. So these, you know, the breakdown that she described is something that we should have been tipped off to even before 9/11. And I think certainly what we've seen, at least from a law enforcement perspective, I can't speak as much to what the intelligence community sees. But from a law enforcement perspective, I think that those numbers that she describes not only hold up, but have held up for a long time. It is true that terrorism and terrorist plots in the UK seem to be, or in Britain at least, seem to be much more concentrated in London than in the other parts of the country. But I think that's probably more explainable. That is the more diffuse nature of it in the U.S. is obviously explainable by the fact that we're simply a bigger country with a population about 5 times as large, with many more not only big cities but remote areas where terrorist cells can not only bore in but where they can conduct training out of the eye of law enforcement and the intelligence community. Which brings me to, I think, the two most important things that I've heard about from the report, and I think that they deserve to be underscored. One of them is the centrality of training. I think that what we've discovered in law enforcement, and I believe this is borne out by both domestic intelligence and the work that the intelligence community has done overseas, is there's an important correlation between not so much training and terrorism, but training and successful terrorism. I think what we find is that in order for these big mass murder plots, of which thankfully very few have been successful, but in order for them to have a real chance for success, you have to have operatives who have received some training. So there's good news and bad news here. The bad news is that this threat is ideology driven. That's the last thing I want to get to. And with the mass availability of the ideology by in the 90s, I guess, when we were doing terrorism cases, most of the preaching that people were exposed to was either in the mosque or on cassette tapes. Now the ideology is massively available through more sophisticated forms of technology. What that ends up meaning, I think, is that there are more people who are exposed to the ideology and more people who are apt to be radicalized. So we have the danger of more of what they call homegrown terrorism. But it still remains a fact that no matter how many people get radicalized, the expertise that's necessary to carry out mass murder attacks really does require training. And therefore, that becomes a very important focus for law enforcement and for the intelligence committee community. The second and final big point I want to get to, and I think it's the most important point of what I've heard about the report, and that is it's absolutely clear that the threat to the West is ideologically driven, and it's not a function of anything else. The other things that terrorist attacks are attributed to are pretext for terrorism. The driving force of this is ideology. I think if that has ever been proved to a fare thee well, it was proved by my defendant back in the 1995 prosecution, the blind sheikh, who, because of his the physical challenges that he has, is completely incapable of doing anything that would be useful to a terrorist organization other than running it. I mean, he can't build a bomb, can't conduct an attack, but he is the most influential figure in those circles. And his mastery over the international jihadist circles comes strictly from the fact that he is a renowned expert in Sharia law, graduated from Al-Azhar University in Egypt, which is the ancient seat of Sunni learning, and it is his acknowledged, almost universally acknowledged, mastery of Islamic doctrine that has directly enabled him to be a supreme supervisory figure in the world of terrorists, and to continue to exercise influence over them. So I think you can't protect the country, any country, unless you understand what the nature of the threat is, what drives it. That's what enables us to predict, you know, who will become a terrorist and what they'll do. If we don't recognize that what fuels this is ideology, we'll never be able to come up with a coherent counterterrorism strategy. So I take my hat off to the authors of the report for homing in on that fact.
Very good. We will now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then pound. When we get to your request, you'll hear a second prompt that will say your microphone has been turned on, you have the floor. We'll be answering questions in the order in which they are received. While we're waiting for our first question, I have a question, to be honest. I'll ask it of the authors. What was it that first interested each of you in pursuing this topic?
Well, my interest, and I can I think speak for both of us on this, is the first of all, the Al-Qaeda threat within Western countries is debated so much, and there's such great levels of interest in it. The question from our point of view was, what's the reality? How much does the rhetoric and the light around this subject? How much of it is actually fact based? From our point of view, that we were interested in getting to the exact numbers, just because it hadn't really been done to our minds in a completely satisfactory way before. But really, I think also just the ability to be able to track trends in a movement across two. I mean, there are many significant differences between the U.S. and U.K., but vaguely comparable Western affluent allies, and see where the differences lie. Now, if there's then hopefully some useful policy perspectives that can be drawn out from that, then that's also an idea. But it was really just an attempt because of the desire for a strong transatlantic cooperation for the American government to have the best information possible on where the threat was coming from.
Very good. Well, we have a question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. One of the most serious threats that has been discussed is nuclear terrorism. We have reports that one of our captives confessed under interrogation that they had brought in 6 or 7 nuclear devices, basically suitcase nukes, into the United States through the southern border. And there are other rumors indicating attempts, at least, to acquire and eventually bring in even more. So although this report is yet unconfirmed, it does seem that it bears more examination and discussion, because we need to decide how we could respond to such a threat, short of, or in fact, whether we might not need to mobilize the entire population.
Well, Andrew may be able to speak on this more effective than I can. I mean, all I would say on that front is that, well, I mean, I think if AQ had that capability, if it had nuclear capability, it would have acted by now against the U.S. because this isn't an organization that's holding back. It's one that's tried to hit America at the peak of its capacity. It tries to hit America with whatever it can. Certainly, with that in mind, I think that if it would be catastrophic if AQ was to get its hands on such material, because the level of death could be so significant. But to my mind, they haven't acquired that material yet.
Yeah, I
well,
agree.
The rumor is, by the way, that there is a plan to bring in at least 40 devices and place them in cities before igniting the first one, and then do it on a random schedule of roughly 2 weeks apart, accompanied by demand that the United States, and this would not just be the United States, other Western countries, surrender to Islam. In other words, we would all have to bow down or the bombs would keep going off. That's the report.
This is Andy McCarthy. I'm just... say about that I think our experience is as Robin suggests, which is that when you're dealing in particular with Al Qaeda, if they could attack us, they would. I mean, there was elaborate planning that went into 9/11 that also ended up with a second component. There was supposed to be a West Coast wave of the attack, but they weren't able to pull it off, so they went with what they had. And we, you know, whether it's by interrogating people that we get an opportunity to interrogate or the other means of collecting intelligence, my understanding is that what we find is that if there were an opportunity to attack us, they would. So I'm always almost amused to hear people speculate about whether a particular attack was motivated by the fact that, you know, it was an anniversary of 9/11 or some other terrorist attack, or they were angry over some person that we just managed to eliminate or what have you. You know, the fact is that they view themselves as at war with the West, and they don't really need additional motivations to carry out attacks. What they need is ability and capacity, and where they have that, they proceed. So I doubt that they would, if they had one nuclear device in the United States and they were capable of detonating it, I think they would detonate it. I don't think they would wait until they had up. And the other aspect of this that's worth underscoring is that while this is an indication, obviously, that that Al-Qaeda doesn't have a nuclear capability, we do know that they have always sought a weapons of mass destruction capability. And we should know that when we have concerns about Iran and North Korea and the stands that we should take against them in the West, the threat is not so much not that this is non-existent, but it's not so much that North Korea or Iran might attack us. The real profound danger that I think the intelligence community worries most about is that they will proliferate those weapons and that technology, particularly to terrorist organizations.
Again, anyone who has a question should hit star and then the pound key to ask your question. While we wait for the next person, I have a follow-up question. Both Mr. McCarthy, you and you, Mr. Simcox, have emphasized the notion that this is primarily a function of ideology more than anything else. And the question that comes to mind for me is how well-versed would you say policymakers, both in the United States and in Great Britain, are actually aware of that?
Well, from the UK perspective, it's changes and shifts depend really on which government is in number 10 at the time. At the moment, I think there's more of an understanding that that there is a very much an ideological component to this. This level of terrorism we face that hasn't always, I don't think, been the case. For example, under the Labour government before, I think there was more of a willingness to perhaps not from the Prime Minister himself, because Tony Blair was tough on this, but from within his own party for people to try and blame things like foreign policy, like the war in Iraq, for terrorism. Now, speaking from a British point of view, I've always had tremendous respect and admiration for the robustness of the American response to this and the uncomplicated nature of being unapologetic about America's actions and its response to the terrorism threat. Now, I feel as if the current administration is definitely a little closer to the European model, let's say, of downplaying the level of ideology, downplaying a lot of aspects that they think for strategic reasons will help, will weaken AQ, and on some level perhaps that's worked, but I feel as if there's probably a lack of honesty now from the White House and from American policy about the nature of the threat, and the nature of the threat does very much remain ideological, and I'm unsure how much good politics can come from being dishonest about that fact.
I think the tendency here has been politically to miniaturize the threat and to discount, if not completely ignore, the role of ideology. So there's been an effort, and it's not just an Obama administration effort, although the Obama administration has certainly intensified it, to portray this as a situation where we have a fringe group of, as they call it, violent extremists, which seem to be unmotivated by any real ideology in particular, who really kill irrationally and wantonly and are not either the point of the spear or in any other way representative of a mainstream construction of Islam. And then I think besides the political leadership, what you then have is the people on the front lines in the different field offices throughout the country, who I think when you speak to them and they feel confident answering you honestly, they will acknowledge that there is a strong ideological component, and that is the assumption that they, you know, proceed with on their day-to-day. So, you know, I think there's a different message in the field than what's being conveyed in Washington. In Washington, regardless of which administration has been in, which party has been in power, that is, there has been a real effort to miniaturize the threat and minimize the role of ideology, which I think has been a pretty dangerous thing.
We do have some more questions from the audience. We'll move on now to our next person with a question.
So this is Hadley Arcus. I hope I'm not coming in with the question too oblique, but this is for Andy mainly. Am I on?
Hi, Hadley.
Hi. I'm trying to deal with this Clapper case that was announced just this week by the court. And Greg Katz's remark that when he was in the Department of Justice trying to deal with the detention cases in Guantanamo, he could round up at most 50 lawyers from all parts of the Department of Justice. But Guantanamo was just filled with lawyers from white shoe firms, invoking processes of discovery and everything. And the unspoken part of the recent decision, the Clapper case, was this thing involved in the question of standing. How likely were these lawyers to have their conversations overheard? But the unspoken part is that they are pretty sure their conversations are going to be overheard because they start with a disposition to defend people they know are out to kill Americans. So I'm wondering, what could we say something about that, Andy? Is there in fact a kind of a core of lawyers who are disposed to lend a helping hand to Al Qaeda, or what kind of is it proper to put up certain cautions to them about being careful about taking those cases, or is the sense that it really doesn't matter? That you can be utterly a lawyer here and be utterly neutral on the question of whether you're going to be defending people who are out to kill Americans.
Well, Hadley, I've gotten in no small amount of hot water over the years by referring to the Gitmo bar and pointing out that
right.
no lawyer has to take an Al Qaeda case at Guantanamo Bay. I think one of the big misdirections that we've seen over the years is certainly since 9/11, is this idea that because every defendant is entitled to counsel, even at government expense, when they're charged, when a defendant is charged with a crime in criminal court, that somehow means we have an obligation to provide, free civilian legal counsel to enemy combatants in wartime, which I think up until about 2004 was an unprecedented idea, would have been a laughable idea in the United States, and is really a misdescription of what has gone on legally post 9/11, because the fact of the matter is the proceedings involving the people down at Guantanamo Bay are not criminal prosecutions. Not to get too deep into the legal niceties of it, but these are affirmative litigations against the United States. They are habeas corpus actions. The Gitmo detainees are not criminal defendants. They're actually plaintiffs against the United States. The lawyers who are assisting them are helping them with their litigation, their positive litigation against the United States in wartime. And the fact is that if you were an American citizen who was in prison and your contention was that you were being detained unlawfully in violation of the Constitution, either because of the conditions of your confinement or because of some defects in the proceeding that landed you in prison, you would not have a right to counsel. You would have to represent yourself. It would be possible for the court to appoint counsel for you, but you would have to bring a pro se action if you couldn't afford counsel. So in my view, this flock of American lawyers, particularly from these white shoe firms, to represent our enemies pro bono, is not something that's admirable. It's something that our law allows, but it's something that we ought to culturally discourage. And I think it's very, very unfortunate that something the rest of the, or when I say the rest of, I mean the non-legal, non-lawyer portion of our population would have the good sense to understand that, you know, you don't flock to the aid of the enemy in wartime. Our American legal culture has become such that the lawyers who do this, far from being condemned, are praised, which you know, is another indication of how upside down our culture is. Hello?
Yeah, I have nothing. Andy has given a very full and comprehensive answer to that. I would have nothing really more to add to what you said.
This is me again, Robin. Thank you for that. I wasn't sure. I thought I might have made everybody hit the off button. I wasn't sure.
I know.
Hi, this is Roger Candelaria. Great discussion. I really appreciate it. You talked about ideology. My question is about the relationship between ideology and religion, and who or how is the best way to respond. Of course, you've talked about the legal system and classifying terrorism and trying to prevent it using intelligence and governmental functions, but I kind of believe the government's not good at all things that it attempts, and I wonder if you could comment on your thoughts as to what are the strengths and limitations of any government action to resist or counter a religious ideology, and if the government's limited, then who and how, what institutions in society are positioned, poised, and capable of some kind of counteraction that's effective?
Sure. I would say that I think this is one of the areas where I think government is at its weakest. In the UK, we had this experience with part of our de-radicalization strategy, where almost the UK government was trying to provide a state-sanctioned version of Islam, say. I can't think of many things the British government is less suited to do than start making theological calls on the ins and outs of the Quran and the Hadith and Islamic texts. I think it's a spectacularly and uniquely bad idea for the British government and for both and the American government itself to get involved in a theological war within Islam. I think if the response has to come and the government can do things to facilitate this response and support the right side, but I think the response has to be essentially from within the Muslim community itself. You're not going to get much credibility by a bureaucrat in Washington or a Mandarin in London going to various parts of the Muslim community and saying, this is the correct interpretation of your religion. It's going to come across as completely, completely unconvincing. So I think it has to be something that's primarily driven within the Muslim communities themselves. With now the state can support that, it can give the certain individuals a hand. It can give funding to the individuals that deserve it, and it can give support to those that are genuinely trying to create a more tolerant and integrated society. But what I would be uncomfortable with is Washington and London and other capitals starting to develop their own ideas of this is how Islam should look, because we tried it briefly in the UK and it was another disaster.
Well, very quickly, we're about out of time. I want to give both Mr. Simcox and Mr. McCarthy one last opportunity to make any closing remarks.
Well, thank you very much for taking the call. Thank you very much for listening. I hope the research is of some use. I hope it has gone some way in challenging the perceptions that we may have over Al-Qaeda. And obviously, this is a threat that's going to continue to diversify. I think it's important that individuals and organizations such as this continue to look for any key shifting trends that may occur within the movement.
I would just say thank you very much for inviting me. I think the report's extremely important, and again, I salute the authors for their achievement.
Thank you.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts today. Thank you to also to our audience. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.